This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann at Otago Polytechnic in Dunedin, and I'm joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How are you?
Very well indeed. We are tromping through, coming up for air.
We are indeed. And I just, every week, am so excited about our next interview, and especially today. It's my great pleasure to introduce Denise Lewis, who's one of the most lovely people I've ever met. Denise, thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you. That was a very nice welcome. Thank you. And it's super exciting to be here and to be doing this podcast. So the podcast that I've worked on is called Fabrication and Lies, just looking at some of the background behind the textile industry and what is the truth and what isn't.
Cool. We shall definitely come to that. First, I want to hear more about you. Where are you to start with?
I am in Auckland. I live in Coatesville, which is a semi-rural area. So I'm looking out at a whole lot of trees and a whole lot of mud at the moment.
Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Auckland. I've lived in a few other places around New Zealand and overseas, but found my way back here for family.
What was it like growing up there?
Well, it was interesting because I was a Westie when I was growing up out in West Auckland before. It was very multicultural. It was very lower socioeconomic where I grew up, and then moved to bigger cities when I got older.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, I've always wanted to be in the textile industry. So from when I was a child, I used to have a big clean sack, like a big paper rubbish bag that was full of scraps of fabric. And that's what I played with from when I was about 3 years old. And begged my parents to save money and buy me a sewing machine when I was about 9. So textiles, clothing, fabric, that's been in my family, and that's been my driving passion since I was quite young.
Is that a family thing, or it seems like a random thing to pick up on your own?
No, it is a family thing. My mother, my grandparents, my auntie were all into either making clothing. My auntie was a milliner. My grandparents, took me to fabric shops and fairs, and my mother used to make all of her own clothes, all of our clothes. It's something the whole family did, embroidery, stitching, fabric art, yeah. Mm.
So is that the mission you followed, the passion you followed?
Well, it is the passion I followed because I went through high school to the point that I couldn't do clothing and textiles at school anymore. So I left when I was 16 and went to Auckland Uni, it was AUT then, and studied apparel technology and admin, and then got straight into the textile industry, started working full-time when I was 18, which was a very long time ago now because I am 60 next week. So, and then my passion was driven by, once I finished my course at Tech, I wanted to get into every aspect of the clothing industry that I could. So I started as a pattern maker, then I went to work in the manufacturing side, I moved overseas so that I could work for bigger companies and see how fabrics were dyed and knitted and woven. Worked in sales, worked in marketing, so just covered the whole gamut of the textile and apparel industry, eventually landing in design and range building, and eventually supplying larger retailers with ranges of clothing and dealing with offshore suppliers.
And is that what you do now?
Now I actually work in the supply chain, so I'm working for the warehouse as their sourcing lead for apparel in New Zealand. looking at, we're dealing with suppliers in China and Bangladesh and working with the buying teams here to look at how to source cost the ranges that they want to get into stores. And a big piece of that is pushing into sustainability initiatives and working with the ethical and sustainability teams here and offshore. So very wow. much interested in the supply chain. And I actually took that job so that I could work with mass market retail for customers that don't have a lot of money to spend and try and make whatever difference I could through the supply chain.
That's a really interesting place to be working at, because I think we've talked to several people on Blowing Bubbles and Sustainable Lens about mm-hmm. changing the fashion industry and moving to everlasting jeans or whatever the thing mm-hmm. is, that you're not buying the pair of jeans, you're buying this service that's going to last forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all of those options end up being really expensive.
They do. Yeah, and I had a really interesting conversation with the ethical sourcing lead outside of this podcast too, just to refresh myself on the whole auditing process and the transparency and validating claims. And a lot of it just adds extra cost. So it's like, how can you do the right thing and the best thing without going crazy on tracing fiber back to where it's grown? We just end up with product that's too expensive. Yeah. Or how to do the best thing without necessarily always calling out a claim, because to validate that and then be able to claim it at retail might cost too much money as well.
Because people are looking for a pair of trousers, not necessarily a sustainable pair of trousers.
Yes. Yeah. Like if they want to buy a pair of jeans, they want to buy a pair of jeans and they'll have their favorite retailer or brand that they want to buy from. But whoever they're going to buy from, they may be looking for, is it made from sustainable cotton? But what goes on behind the scenes and what qualifies as sustainable cotton, that is the big mystery that I find really interesting. Because, for example, if you look at what goes into processing organic cotton, it might be the wrong thing to say, but for me that is segregation through the supply chain. Like, why do we need to not have a fiber fly into the path of another fiber for cross-contamination to call it organic? I personally think that's lunacy and it's adding costs through the supply chain. There's other initiatives that can deliver good product and a good sustainable solution at the right price for the average person that actually in New Zealand hasn't got a lot of money to spend.
This is a philosophical question. If one of the problems that's caused this need for sustainability is that we're addicted to stuff,
yes.
and almost all of the business models rely on us buying more stuff, no matter what you're doing, it's not going to help. How are you balancing that, or how is that tension being worked out?
Tension is the right word for that one, and that is something in my role that I don't directly impact where I'm working, but it is something that very much intrigues and fascinates me, because we all consume way too much product, without a doubt. And actually, one of the measures that we pushed into it work about a year ago was to look at how much product's actually going into sale and going into markdown at the end of the season. So why are we producing all of these garments that we just don't need? And I think that is a long-term issue for retail at any level, because the retail model needs to change, in my perspective, so that it's not just being driven on consumption and volume. How to generate that is going to be a big challenge for big box retail, is how to stay in business with diminishing demand, which I think we're going to need further further through the process of shifting, because people can't keep over consuming product. It's one of the biggest problems. The apparel supply chain is one of the biggest problems. So it's like, in the here and now, what are the quickest wins? That's to move to more sustainable solutions. And that's not just the fabric, that's about looking after the workers, making sure the factories are audited, what's going on in local communities. So managing that just as much as making sure that we're not producing garments that won't last very long, so then you've got to go and buy a new one or replace it soon. And actually, for all of us as individuals, we need to stop buying a lot less product.
Yet the retailer needs us to buy more stuff.
Yeah, they do. There's the quandary. There is the quandary, absolutely. And sitting within retail, the piece of the puzzle that I see as well is that whole margin mix piece, how to keep a business profitable over the course of time. We've managed in the apparel area at the warehouse to, this is all unsubstantiated, but overall about 90% of the apparel now has a sustainable attribute in the fabric. but that obviously needs to be validated before it gets called out properly. So we've pushed into switching over the fabrics. That is a lot easier than it is for some other areas like hard goods. So you can do the fabric piece first. That's very visible to customers. It doesn't make the biggest change to sustainability. It's how is that fabric processed through the supply chain, the dyeing, the knitting, the weaving. That's more important, actually, than if it's organic cotton or better cotton or recycled polyester.
So do you, when you're looking at the options for pick a random set of clothes that you're looking at buying, socks, when you're presented with the options, do you then go and like follow back in the supply chain to see how that's being produced?
I don't directly. So there's an ethical and auditing team that go deal with the factory audits and make sure that basically if a factory or a supplier hasn't been approved, we can't cost with them. So the team that I work with, we cannot start negotiating. We can't start trying to source, and we definitely can't get orders placed. So that process is in place. Sorry, I lost my train of thought on your question. Then that wasn't very helpful.
You're talking about ethical sourcing, and the pair of socks that I want to buy. Has somebody done the work for me?
Right. Okay. So the buyers would come to us and go, here's my product plan. I want you to go and find for me XYZ product, this quantity, this is when I need it by. We then go to the factories that are ethically onboarded, that we're able to work with, and we start to deal with them on, we would like you to give us a price for this product or explain how it's being made. So during that process, we push into understanding what the fabrics are, what the options are. Is there a more sustainable option? Could we be using less water? There's no hazardous chemicals. So those questions do come up when we're negotiating. In terms of actually managing through the supply chain, that's in the very early stages for apparel. It's very hard to do. There's many steps. There is a process underway over the next few years for those different tiers through the supply chain to be audited. I think you'd find globally for most manufacturers, unless they're vertically integrated, as in they're buying the fibre and then they're in control of the factory end to end, I would say that there's very few that have visibility through the supply chain. So they can tell you that their cotton is sustainable or it's organic or it's better cotton or whatever it might be, but how that fabric's been processed, they probably don't know.
Given that most of this is invisible to the customer, but also to your competitors, I presume, how do you all move together as a, because it's a we in terms of society, but it's a individual use in terms of the different big boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sort of sharing about the best ways of doing sustainability?
There is a level of sharing. It is a very new, if we look at sustainability overall, this journey really is still quite new. I've been at the warehouse 5 years now. I've been there 3 years in the sourcing role. And the shift in 3 years has been phenomenal. And there definitely is a structure and a sharing of people in different pieces of the business. It comes down from the executive. We're given goals. We have targets. In my role for apparel sourcing, we very much pushed into sustainability. So we would then go back and present to the product teams, the first option is the most sustainable option. We would present the option for a recycled polyester, and then second option would be virgin polyester, for example. So I think, yes, there's a structure in place, but it comes down to the passion of the people driving it. And the team that I work with are very passionate, and that's part of why I took on this study, because I wanted to understand more. What can I do better? How can we align on more systems? And there's a very passionate bunch of people within the business, and within our apparel sourcing area, it is absolutely a focus. And it gets rolled out to the business. We shout out every season how we're doing with sustainability targets. We set our own goals, packaging, product, processing through the supply chain. A lot of that's not discussed externally. It's just us trying to do the best thing we can.
Let's take your music track. Let's have Paloma Faith, Power to the Peaceful. Why this one?
I just really like the lyrics, and I think it comes down to us all. It's such a mystery, sustainability. We've all just got to do the best thing that we can and be human and make the best decisions.
Oh, I don't believe in war. No, it makes no sense at all. But I can't stop breathing. And I can't explain the way people cause each other pain. it could be sweeter, baby.
Sprite of the forest of Orokonui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mahi aranui kia koutou koutou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around you, this journey we're all on together has proven to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art. Perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years has been very tough. And it's important that we give ourselves and each other time and space and love and care, compassion and understanding, that we recognise that we're still in a phase of recovery, and maybe for some time, and that there's nothing wrong with that. I know for myself, of course, the living world is a great comfort. And I speak to you now from my beautiful room in Soporto Bello, where I'm staying with my lovely whānau at the moment, having separated from my partner of the last 10 years. And staying with my beautiful whānau is really helping me to recover and recalibrate, and I feel very fortunate for this. So I hope that for you, you have support around you in this time, whether it's from other human beings or other life forms, of which there are so many, an infinite number, I'm sure. I've just been visited by Lord Momo, my little brother's cat, who has quite a different way of expressing himself from my cat, Captain Arthur Hastings. And of course, this has helped me to remember that we are all completely individual, that our brain myelinizes individually, that we experience reality uniquely and individually, and our thoughts, feelings, emotions, the way we communicate, how we communicate, what we communicate, all of these are so unique to us. And so, of course, by coming together and sharing and documenting and remembering and treasuring these aspects of ourselves and one another, we build such a rich repository of wisdom and joyful memories to return to. I know that for myself, a number of my dear friends have passed on recently to the other realm. And for me, I very much feel them with me. And of course, there are so many different ways to conceptualize life and death and consciousness and the soul and the life force, the Māori, all these things, the Wairua, all of these things. There are so many different names that we've given them, and I'm sure that we'll continue to give them. But for me, it all comes back to our love and our capacity to love. That even if someone is not with us in their physical form, which we so dearly love still, we can appreciate them in another way. Their nurturing energy, I believe, lives on. And I felt this many a time with my dear friend Phil passing, my dear friend Martin recently passing, my grandfather Albert passing, all of these beautiful people, and most recently, the lovely Michael Fay, who contributed greatly to Orokonui. Their words live on in our hearts, their art lives on in the outer world, and those words of encouragement, which at the time may seem so small, live on. And this is why I think it's so important when we can to acknowledge what we love about those around us, be they human or otherwise, and that we share that love with them verbally or in our actions. So I hope for you that you're having the opportunity to share the love that you feel with yourself and with those around you. And of course, being part of this show is one of the ways that I can do that. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. And I'll talk with you again soon. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Denise Lewis.
Denise, we are going to listen to your podcast. What would you like listeners to know about your podcast before they hear it?
I would like them to know that we all have a part to play, and there are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that we will never know about, and we all just need to do the best thing we can to make a difference. Welcome to Fabrication and Lies, where we will be taking a look at the clothing industry and attempting to unravel some of the mystery around which fabrics are actually more sustainable, asking is organic cotton a better choice than non-organic cotton, and what are retailers hiding from us? What is actually going on behind the scenes? I'm Denise Lewis. I'm enrolled in the Master of Sustainable Business program at the University of Otago, alongside my role as sourcing and quality lead for apparel at The Warehouse in New Zealand. I've been in the apparel industry for over 30 years, making my working life an uncomfortable mix of retail, which is a business founded on driving consumption, and apparel, an industry now recognized as a significant contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. The Science Based Targets website notes that the global apparel and footwear sector produces more GHG emissions than the shipping and aviation sectors combined. The challenge is to understand the complexities of a global supply chain. How can we make sustainable choices with economic and social pressures at both ends of the supply chain and everywhere in between? So to get the conversation going, let's head to the Warehouse Sourcing Office in Bangladesh to meet the manager there, Peter McKenna. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning, Denise. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for joining me today. So could you let us know just a little bit about your background and how long you've been in Bangladesh?
Sure. My name's Peter McKenna. And like Denise, I've been working in the garment industry for more than 30 years. So we're both quite experienced in this sector. I've spent the last 12 years in Bangladesh working on production and product development. And also I've been working quite heavily in terms of looking at sustainability and sustainability within manufacture.
Thanks. And that is why I wanted to have you here today, because you've got a really strong background in what actually goes on from end to end through garment production. My first question really is, the complexity of the supply chain from fibre to finished product has been described as opaque. It's hard to know what's really going on. And the New York Times published a great article in 2022 titled, "That Cotton T-Shirt May Not Be As Organic As You Think." It's an expose into organic cotton produced in India and raised some really great questions. So can I start by asking you about organic cotton? There's an assumption that organic cotton is better for the environment by not using chemicals and pesticides. But when we look through the supply chain from the cotton fibre production to the finished garments, there's a really different picture. What's your perspective on this?
Well, my perspective on organic cotton within the production process in Bangladesh, we don't actually physically see the cotton being grown in the fields in India. But once the fibre comes into Bangladesh, firstly, it's spun into yarn, and then it's woven or knitted, and then it's either dyed or printed, and then it goes on to a production line. We see in our company, because our company is very much hands on and feet on the ground here in Bangladesh, so we actually see all parts of that production process. So we go to the spinning mills, and we go to the knitters or the dye or the weavers, and we visit the dye plants, and we see the garments being made in the factory. I have a team of 6 people who are regularly out in the factory, like at least 4 days every week, seeing garments being made. As I said, apart from actually seeing the physical fiber being grown in the fields, we have a really close visibility on things which are organic. And this is quite common amongst the bigger retailers who are here in Bangladesh. You know, they all have offices, they all have teams, they all have sustainability teams. They have people who are out in the factories seeing what's happening and seeing what's being done. So I can understand that if you're just buying something from a factory, if that's your operation and they say, yes, it's organic, maybe there might be a level of visibility, maybe there might not be a level of visibility. But when your feet on the ground in a country, as we are in Bangladesh, you see everything. You see everything from spinning to the garments being put in the poly bags and put in the boxes and being shipped out to the destination country. So I don't necessarily agree that some people might not have visibility. I think that we do. And I think most of the big retail brands that are here have a visibility of it.
And so for a product that is using organic cotton, it's completely separate right through the production process. It's in separate areas. So there's a different flow from end to end for that product, right? So there may be a little bit of extra cost involved in getting it from A to B in terms of separating it through the normal supply chain to control the fact. Okay.
Yeah, I think there's probably a small cost. I mean, it may not bear to the level to which organic cotton can be separately priced. Within the production supply chain, I'm not talking about the cotton being grown, but within the production process, the garments are dyed in dye plants. They're knitted or woven in weaving plants. It's just a specifically dedicated unit. But the people who work in those factories are not being paid any more for working on organic cotton. They still get the same salary.
Okay. And so for the bulk of the product that the warehouse is making there in Bangladesh is not organic cotton. Yeah. So if we look at better cotton, that is what you're working with there. So if we then look at non-organic cotton, better cotton is the largest global initiative for sustainable cotton production. Their website states that in just over 10 years, we've become the world's largest cotton sustainability program. Our mission to help cotton communities survive and thrive while protecting and restoring the environment. So if we're looking at Better Cotton as an initiative, they've got quite a holistic approach. They're supporting and educating farmers on how to sustainably manage crops and farms. They reach into communities to educate around social issues like gender equality, economic literacy, and decent working conditions. So it's quite a different approach to where we go. Organic cotton is focused on not using pesticides, keeping it separate through the production supply chain so there's no cross-contamination of anything. However, Better Cotton currently work with a system of mass balance. So there have been challenges around traceability to follow the track of the grown cotton through the supply chain to finished garments. And Better Cotton began to address that last year with traceability now back to the country of origin where the cotton's grown. And they're expecting to have traceability back to the gin, which is one step removed from the farm by the end of 2025. So I suppose my question here for you is, what's your perspective on traceability of the actual fibre? Does it really matter? And what value does it add?
Sustainability has to be a key part of all of our approaches. Anyone who actually cares about the planet that they live on has to care about the product and where it comes from. I think the world has moved on to a certain extent from the time when it was just, you just got cotton from somewhere at the cheapest price that you could get it and made it into a t-shirt as quickly and as easily as possible and then sold it at the lowest price. For me, it's very important looking at the actual source of the fiber and checking and seeing that it's been grown in a sustainable way, seeing that, you know, the land that we live on is being maintained and will be here to be passed on to the next generation, I think is very, very important because, you know, we all have families that we want to try and pass the future on to. So growing, looking after the land and also looking after the workers, it has to be a key element. We have traceability documents, so we do have a certain level of trust in terms of the fact that it is BCI, but we do have a documentation chain to show that it actually is a BCI fibre. The fibre comes to Bangladesh with the BCI certificate. We then are able to trace that through the whole process from spinning to weaving or knitting to dyeing to being made up into garments in the factories to be put into the poly bag to be shipped out to our customers.
Yeah. So two kind of different but good initiatives there with the organic cotton and then the Better Cotton initiative. So I wanted to ask you about in April this year, there was a report, Fashion Crimes, was published by EarthSight. And that article was around what was referred to as dirty Brazilian cotton. They called out land grabbing, illegal deforestation and impacts on local communities. So obviously very emotive issues. Yeah. And Better Cotton was actually referenced in that report. And in response, they undertook an independent audit and shared those findings. They identified three farms licensed to sell Better Cotton. The audit said that they did not find any non-compliances against the Better Cotton principles and criteria in those farms. So it was like this massive explosion of a report online and in the media. Then Better Cotton went in and did their investigation and came back with their findings quite quickly, which was really good to see that chain of response there. Interestingly, Better Cotton also called out, no single actor can adequately tackle the systemic changes underlying sustainability issues. So for me, reading that article and looking at their responses really highlighted that complexity in the cotton supply chain, what I think got referred to as opacity in that report. Like, how do we truly know what is going on? And what are your thoughts on that? Can you share your perspective on complexity and particularly trust through the supply chain to get garments into stores in New Zealand?
Our team here is working very closely at the moment with the New Zealand team to ensure that all standards and all standards and all visibility is maintained throughout the supply chain in Bangladesh. And we're currently looking at all of our, not just our garment makers, but the people who do the dyeing and the people who do the knitting and the people who do the first stage processing. We're about to bring in a thing called an Okotex approval level on some of our garments. And we're looking at actually maintaining an approval level of Okotex suppliers throughout all of our supply chain. But that's something that we're rolling out over the next 2 years. Okotex is a system where it ensures that there's no harmful chemicals or any harmful products going into the supply chain. A factory will be approved to say that there's no harmful chemicals being used in the screen print or in the garment washing process. And that way it does two things. Firstly, obviously we follow the process of checking that there's no harmful chemicals involved in any of our garments, which is great. But what it also makes us do is it makes us document every supplier to the warehouse through the supply chain, so that we get to see not just the garments being stitched and check that the stitching is okay on them, but we actually document and we're factory visiting and we're checking that the factory is working to a certain approved levels of standard, because the factory, let's say a dyeing factory, works to an Okotex accreditation. That means that factory has been, that mill has been certified to say that there's no harmful chemicals or no harmful product going into any of our garments. We do it anyway, but it forces us to actually document things through our supply chain. And I mean, I joined the company 4 years ago, and at that point, we were smaller and we just opened our own office. So we didn't have the level of visibility. Now I've been, and my team have all been, to the people who do the dyeing, the people who do the knitting, the people who do the people who do the printing of the denim. And that way, you just get to ensure that through your supply chain, that people are working to the standards that somebody like the warehouse would expect of their suppliers.
It's a good point too. It's like there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. You know, you go into a store here, you look at a t-shirt and the messages that get out to consumers. It's like there's this continual raising of the bar and improving of standards offshore, and through that process that you're managing and leading, that actually doesn't get translated here, and it doesn't necessarily need to, you know, the right things being done. So I wanted to ask you something about, so is the future vision to connect retailers directly with farms and building trust through a more transparent supply chain? That's sort of a broad question, because I was reading, there was an academic article and that was published in the Sustainability Journal in 2022, which suggested that moving toward a new model of organic agroforestry, which is integrating trees with crops and pasture, might lead to more sustainable supply chains. So to quote from that article, markets play a significant role in fostering more sustainable supply chains. They call out the challenges of connecting brands to farmers, or we could say retailers to farmers, and market mechanisms such as contracts and certifications, and that certification by external auditing has a high cost, which ultimately leads to less money paid to farmers. So it's that whole connect of what's the future vision, do you think, and are we moving in a direction of connecting more, for example, how the fibre is grown, where the fibre is coming from, directly with the retailers, like rather than having all these middlemen in between? Is it becoming more of a vertical operation?
Absolutely. Since I joined the warehouse, the UK retailer that I've really followed is Primark. So one of the key things that they did, they have started to work directly with farms.
Mm-hmm.
So that they work with farms and farmers, and they then are involved in the purchase process of buying in the yarn, the fibre that comes into their supply chain. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting. I was in the UK a few weeks ago, and there was a big, big display of the sustainability story of this is the farm where certain amounts of our product was grown. It gave this person an opportunity. You know, we paid a fair price. We worked with this farmer. We didn't just work with another conglomeration who were another markup on top of the process.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, in an ideal world, like a fair living wage would be, you know, is paid to communities producing the cotton and making the garments. Higher retail prices would be paid for more sustainable products, and that global consumption would reduce. And that we'd have more transparency end to end through, and more trust through the supply chain. Yeah.
If I can just quickly tell you about one of our suppliers, because that, you know, we are, you know, we're not the biggest retailer in the world. We are but we are actually working with a factory in Pakistan, which I visited a few months ago. And it's a huge concern. It's one of the biggest manufacturers of bedding and fleece and jersey in Bangladesh, in Pakistan. And they actually own cotton farms. And I do think that that level of control of the initial cotton process is going to be part of the process for the future.
It's an interesting change, isn't it? It's going to be interesting time looking back in 5 years to see where we are versus where we are now.
I was actually in a factory making recycled poly bags a few months ago with a merchandiser from one factory, and we commented saying that 10 years ago our interest was making this t-shirt or this polo shirt, was getting the knitted collar right and making sure that we could get the best price and an on-time delivery. And now we're looking at recycled polyester pellets and making recycled poly bags. So the world has definitely changed, and it's going to keep on changing.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to ask you one last thing, which is, if you could change one thing right now which would make the most significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
Can I have two?
Yes.
Okay, I'll have two. Firstly, I think that we can talk about sustainability all the time. And I think that in this economic climate, people aren't just buying clothes and buying clothes and buying clothes. Mm-hmm. I think people buy things and they want them to last. And I think that you can say, oh, this garment is very sustainable, but if it doesn't wash brilliantly, or people just think, oh, it doesn't look very good after two or three washes, I'll just bin that one and get a new one, it's not sustainable. So yeah. I think that a focus on quality and a focus on sustainability, and like trying to achieve the best quality that you can at the price, it is really important, because if you make a garment and it lasts, it's more sustainable. Mm-hmm. So making quality garments, and for people like ourselves, where we're dealing with people on tighter budgets, making good quality garments that last multiplies incredibly on sustainability. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we've worked on a lot over the last 3 or 4 years, is improving the quality of our garments. The second thing is the workers in the factories, because we can talk about sustainability for a long time, but if the workers aren't getting a decent wage, then how is it sustainable? You know, yeah. if people aren't getting by, if people aren't making enough to actually get their children educated, then how is it sustainable? I think the market pressures, where the wages in Bangladesh have got the minimum wages have increased like by a reasonable amount to make it a more living wage in the last year. We saw a lot of action by the trade unions, etc., to ensure that the workers were getting paid better and were getting a more livable wage. What we haven't really seen, though, is an increase in price. Anything that can be done to improve the lives of the people that are doing the job, doing the work, is going to be a big plus for us as a sustainable retailer. So those are the two things I'd wish for. One would be that we make a good product that mm-hmm. lasts, and then we don't have to make three, we have to just make one, and it doesn't go into landfill. And two, that the workers in the countries which are developing economies where our garments are made are actually getting a decent living and are able to improve on their own lives as well.
Yeah, those are great call outs, because we are, and a global community, and I think that's becoming more and more apparent. The United Nations Climate Changes Fashion Industry Charter for Climate Action, quite the name, identified clothing and textiles as the third largest manufacturing sector in the world. So, like, stepping into that challenge there in these industries, even small steps like that, right, it's going to make a significant difference. And I think even though we might not be fully informed, we might not have all the answers right now, if we're looking after the people, if we're looking after the global community, it can only be better.
We're one planet and it's all connected. I've lived in this country for the last 12 years. And you physically see the emergence of more of the middle class over the last 12 years, and it has become a more tiered economy rather than just the rich and the poor. There is an emerging middle class, and that is really an important and excellent thing to see within this country.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, you know, like when we started talking right at the beginning of this chat, we were talking about it's very visible in the media. Oh, organic cotton must be better. And then you start to scratch underneath the surface and look at actually it's more than just calling out organic cotton, BCI cotton. It's like actually there's so much more to it. There's an opportunity to make such a big difference on many different levels. And it's not just labeling a fibre.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the thing that we haven't talked about is one of the things that I'm very interested in, which is in process control. So looking at the processes within the manufacturing of the garments and fabric and the preparation of fabric is a huge consumer of both energy and water.
Yeah.
And we have done work with our team here and with the people in New Zealand on things like the reduction of water in some of our processes and the use of energy within our processes. We've done a lot of work where we're looking at processes where the dyeing cycle is shorter, they use better chemicals, and they use much less water. When I first came here and started looking at this issue, it used to take around about 100 litres of water to dye a kilo of jersey fabric. And now with different technologies and changing in processes, it's come down to about 40. To give people perspective, a kilo of jersey is about 3 men's t-shirts. So that's 60 liters. That's 20 liters of saving per t-shirt. And if you think that some of the factories that we work with will make 3-4 million t-shirts a month, it's a lake. It's a
significant.
Lake of water.
It's significant, right? And it's like this processing goes on behind whatever the call out might be, organic versus non-organic cottons, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there are all these other areas that have such a big impact on the climate, on communities. Yeah. Well, it's been good to talk to you, Peter. Thank you for your time. I feel like we've got 100 more things we could drill into. Have to do another podcast another time.
Definitely.
Thank you.
All right, cool.
Denise, that was really interesting. What was the most powerful message that you took from the interview and from the podcast process?
The most powerful message for me was to actually realise that even though New Zealand is a smallish island nation, we are part of a huge global community. And just acknowledging that and understanding that interlinking between what happens overseas, what happens here, that we're all interdependent on each other.
It is indeed a very small world, and we are connected, and the decisions that we make impact on everybody. And we don't think about that enough, I think. So when the warehouse and other of the bigger stores that sell a more economical, affordable product get some pretty bad press, but we don't think about the positive impact of all of the families in other countries that get to survive because somebody in New Zealand is buying their product.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that came out very much in the people, because I did actually interview a couple of people that weren't included in the podcast for some background, you know, and I deal with the teams in Bangladesh and China all the time, and particularly in Bangladesh, very community focused. And yeah, they're reliant on us buying these products, us as in customers in retail in New Zealand, buying products to keep their families and communities afloat. They have a lot more labour laws and standards, etc., around them than I think a lot of people appreciate. And I make sure personally that I spend a lot of time talking to those people, working in evenings on the phone, just to make sure that we are making the right decisions and we're doing the right things.
Because every time we buy that product, we're party to that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that we buy, we're saying we agree with the way this product is made and the way those employees are treated and the way that it's even shipped to New Zealand. We're agreeing that that's okay by buying it in the first place. And so that puts a huge responsibility on you to broker that deal.
It's an interesting dynamic, and actually through the process of the podcast too drew out more for me. And I've been up to Bangladesh myself, but just once for work. And it's a huge global community up there of retailers of many different levels, but some very big retailers have their offices there. So what we buy into as well is impacted by a global retail supply community. It's also not just New Zealand retail going, I would like you to make XYZ and ship it to New Zealand. We're part of a whole structure of society and infrastructure up there that's delivering product. If you think about the Humble t-shirt, there's people all around the world wearing t-shirts, and the vast majority of them will be coming from China and Bangladesh. Yeah, and it's something that we have no visibility of here at all.
And realistically, what are the chances that we would ever be able to generate, I mean, even if we took away the wants and we just focused on needs, we can't possibly generate everything that we need in New Zealand to live in the world as we live in it now, to be able to continue to engage in with the rest of the world. Even if you just look at the technology side of things, we can't make the kind of tech that we need to be able to communicate with the rest of the world. And actually, we've been importing product for as long as there have been people coming here. So and we forget that, I think.
And it's that balance between, ideally, we'd love to be just living with New Zealand-made product. I absolutely get that. But we still have a country which is generally on a reasonably mid to low income where people are struggling to make ends meet. And there are certain things that we just don't want people to feel like clothing their families as a luxury or getting food on their table, right? So it's just finding that right mix.
Hmm. Do you have New Zealand-made apparel in the stores? Is that a thing?
Not that I'm aware of. When I was a buyer there 20-something years ago, we used to, but it wasn't easy because the costs are just so high. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, would love to see that change just for the New Zealand industry perspective. But right now, it's not really viable unless people want to start paying hundreds of dollars for items of clothing.
I have some questions to end the show and almost negative time to ask them, so we're going to have to really wriggle.
Okay.
It suits you right for being so interesting. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh, the biggest success I've had? This is going to sound ridiculous, but actually learning about sustainability and at the tail, what most people would perceive as the tail end of my career, I feel like I'm learning something completely new, and rather than running away from the challenge of retail and apparel, I feel like I've thrown myself in there, and going back to uni was scary because I don't know how anything works. So thank you to Marweta and all the other amazing people there, because this was terrifying. So that's probably been one of my biggest successes. Yeah.
What is your superpower?
My superpower? I don't know if I have a superpower. Staying afloat.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Not really, no. I wouldn't consider myself an activist, but I will fight for what I believe in.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Doing the right thing and making a change. Every morning, get up, be the best person you can be, and try and change one small thing in the world.
That sounds like good advice. So another free hit for you is, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, also get out of bed every morning, be the best person you can be, and make one small positive change in the world.
Sounds good to me twice. Mawira.
Denise, I really just want to thank you very much for your contribution to our shared learning space. It has been really lovely having you in the classroom, and the way that you bring all of your experience that came, you know, from everything you bought, from everything you learned right up until now, and the value that that added, because you had a perspective that came from experience. And I really appreciated that, and I saw everyone else in the classroom appreciate it too. Thank you very much for sharing with us today, for your podcast, for your thoughtfulness, for your kindness, and we wish you all the best for the future.
Kia ora. Thank you very much, and thank you for scaring me into doing a podcast.
My pleasure.
Okay, so we get to choose what we're going out to. I have got six things lined up that I found in the collection. Elvis, blue suede shoes.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show. Three to get ready now, go cat go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe.
Nancy Sinatra, these boots are made for walking.
And that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
They've all got a fashion theme here, especially the next two. Bowie, fashion. Lady Gaga, fashion, but with an exclamation mark. The Kink, dedicated follower of fashion. And last, because I couldn't resist it, Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy.
I'm too sexy for my love, too sexy for my love, love's going to leave.
Yeah, that one.
It hurts. And I am too sexy for Milan, too sexy for Milan, New York and Japan. And I am too sexy for your party, too sexy for your party, no way I'm disco dancing. I'm a model, you know what I mean. I do my little turn on the catwalk. Yeah, on the catwalk. On the catwalk, yeah. I do my little turn on the catwalk. By far. And I'm too sexy for my hat, too sexy for my hat, what you think about that? I'm a model, you know what I mean, and I do my little turn on the catwalk, yeah, on the catwalk, on the catwalk, yeah, I shake my little touch.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This was an episode from our Coming Up for Air series. Today's contribution was from Denise Lewis, who has been talking. With Mawira Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show.
My love, love's going to leave me. And I'm too sexy for this song.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.